We have a very special guest today. His name is Matt Lewis. He's a senior contributor from the Daily Caller. He's the editor of a blog called The Quotable Rogue, The Ideals of Sarah Palin in Her Own Words, a columnist for served as a columnist for Politics Daily and a blogger for townhall.com. He's appeared on, this is a long list, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, CNN, or C-SPAN, ABC, Nightline, Real Time with Bill Maher, radio shows like The Talk of the Nation, G. Gordon Liddy Show, Lou Dobbs Radio, and, of course, now the Ty J. Young Show. And Mr. Lewis currently hosts his own podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes and is a regular on and co-host on Blogging Heads TV. Mr. Lewis, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. You made an appearance on Minnesota Public Radio. I think you've been talking about this a good bit. And essentially, liberals have tried to frame in the media conservatives as not intellectual, as kind of knuckle draggers. And you've made the other side of that case. I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, conservatism actually began as an intellectual movement. A lot of people don't know that, but liberalism was really cobbled together. You know, basically modern liberalism was cobbled together basically by Franklin Roosevelt, and it was a way to win elections. So they would take, you know, oh, let's get some union people here, let's get some radical progressives here. So it wasn't really based on ideas as much as it was based on building voting blocks. But conservatism actually arose as an intellectual movement, really hearkening back to Edmund Burke, the British parliamentarian. But, you know, in modern times, people like Hayek, William F. Buckley. And so there's a proud tradition of conservative intellectuals, and I think a lot of times they're forgotten about. But even nowadays, there are a lot of really smart, eloquent conservatives and Republicans. And I would say, looking ahead, looking to the future, people like Marco Rubio in Florida and Paul Ryan are prime examples of very eloquent and intelligent conservatives who I think are going to lead into the future.
You know, I completely agree with your position there, but why, as conservatives, and certainly I am one, why as conservatives have we allowed, or how has it happened that the liberal press has kind of framed conservatives as anti-science, anti-intellectual? How have they effectively done that?
Well, I think some of it is clearly that the left has attempted to do this and has been adept at playing politics. But in fairness, I think that conservatives have sort of helped create this problem. And it really stems from the fact that both sides do play politics and both sides have to win elections.
Right.
And one of the things that Republicans did, and you know, Ronald Reagan, who's one of my heroes, did this, was sort of categorize himself as just a regular guy up against those pointy-headed intellectuals, those people at Harvard.
Right.
And it works politically. It's a populist move. Now, keep in mind, Reagan was incredibly intelligent and very well-read and a great writer. So Reagan was a very smart guy, but he helped sort of play this role as sort of the everyman. And over time, I think it helped cement the notion that Republicans and conservatives were, you know, anti-intellectual. In fact, I think what we are is anti-elitist, not anti-intellectual.
We're very well said. Let me get your read on the Supreme Court and their comments, anti-liberal comments coming from the Supreme Court, and even the justices that are considered liberal. It seemed like they were throwing softballs to the, you know, the folks that were arguing for Obamacare, and it seemed like the Obamacare side fell on their face. Love to get your read on that and get your read on how the media seemed to panic after that.
It was fascinating. I mean, as you know, there are nine justices. Four are Democratic appointees and five are Republican, appointed by Republicans. And the four Democrat appointees are going to vote to uphold the law. So they're going to vote with Obamacare. So really the question is over the five Republican appointees. And clearly during the arguments, the anti-Obamacare side clearly dominated. And really there was no answer. The government, the Solicitor General, was unable to answer the question, about the individual mandate. If you can force me to buy insurance, what can't you force me to buy, or what can't you force me to do? The government, the Solicitor General, had no answer to that. So it clearly appeared that the conservative side, the anti-Obamacare side, won the debate. Now, the problem, though, is that It only takes one, since the four Democratic appointees on the court, the four justices, are going to vote, you know, essentially as a block to uphold the law, it only takes one Republican appointee, probably Justice Kennedy, to right. flip sides. So I still think, despite the fact that it was a very bad debate for Obamacare, I still think it's a flip of the coin whether or not this thing will be upheld or overturned.
So you think it's 50-50 at this point?
I do. And in part of it might be that I'm just naturally skeptical or cynical. We've been burned so many times by the Supreme Court.
Right.
But I think it's a toss of the coin right now.
What do you make of the president coming out ahead and, by all accounts, trying to intimidate the Supreme Court into making a decision in his favor?
It's really unfortunate. And yesterday, you know, President Obama came out and used, I think, very heated rhetoric and demagogic rhetoric to attack Paul Ryan's budget. And it's very sad to see this because, you know, President Obama ran on a campaign of hope and change. He talks about uniting Americans, and he talks about, you know, restoring civility into political discourse. And then he goes out and uses, you know, very divisive and harsh rhetoric. So I think it's very unfortunate and kind of sad. I think it's actually, interestingly, if Obama had governed the way that he campaigned, if he had truly become a post-partisan leader, and if he had actually eschewed playing these political games, I really think he could have been unbeatable, and he could have essentially ended the Republican Party. But because he decided to become a regular politician, I actually think that it was a missed opportunity for him.
Do you think he's become a regular politician? Because as I look at this, and I'm biased, there's no question about that, but as I watch his presidency and I watch his actions and I listen to his words, he is more divisive than any president that I can remember. And certainly, it seems like he makes an effort to divide the country. Would you characterize him as a regular politician, or would you say that he's more divisive than presidents in recent history? Would you agree with what I was thinking?
Well, I don't know about historically, but I will say I think he had a chance to become something special. He had a chance to transcend politics, to become kind of a post-partisan 21st century leader, someone who really could have devastated the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And instead, he chose to be political. He chose to go to the left. He chose to, instead of focusing on the economy, to push this socialized health care policy, ram it down our throats. And when he did that, I think he chose to become all too human, all too political. And so he might win re-election, I'm not sure, but he's not going to be, you know, this special Reagan-esque, FDR-esque figure. He's going to be just another Democratic politician.
All right. Given those facts about Obamacare pushing it forward, trying to intimidate the Supreme Court, how does he continue to have a support ratings or approval ratings in the mid-40s? How does he continue that, you think?
Well, I think that there are two reasons. One, when he wants to turn on the charm, he can.
And that's true.
He still can be very likable. The other thing is just he's competing against other people who also aren't terribly charismatic or charming. And so, you know, when you compare Obama to Romney or Rick Santorum, all of a sudden he doesn't seem quite so bad, especially if you're not ideological. I mean, if you're a conservative, you know that Romney and Santorum, that their policies are going to be better for the country.
Right.
But if you're just Joe Sixpack, in terms of personality, compared to those guys, Obama's not so bad.
What percentage of the country do you think is a Joe Sixpack mentality, do you think?
Well, it's certainly the vast majority. I mean, I think that if you were to sort of take 100% of the population, there's probably about, you know, 15% who are like, you know, hardcore ideological conservatives, and maybe that same amount who are hardcore ideological liberals. And then there are people who lean Republican, who lean liberal, but clearly the average person who really only thinks about politics a few minutes a day, that's what matters. And the hard part for us, people who work in politics or people who work in journalism,
right,
is to keep, you know, Dick Morris actually said the hardest thing is to to be an insider but think like an outsider.
Right.
Because we become, you know, if you do a radio show, if you follow politics closely, in a way you become out of touch because you start to think everyone watches Fox all the time. Everyone reads the paper. And the truth is they're watching the Baltimore Orioles right now.
Right.
It's funny. I was, as you were saying that, I'm thinking, I don't think about politics just a couple of minutes a day. All right, shifting to Romney, it looks like after these primaries this week that he's probably going to get the nomination. If he does, who do you think he chooses for a VP?
Very good question. And I would say there's really two questions. Who should he choose?
Right.
Who do I think he will choose?
Right.
I would like to see him pick either Marco Rubio or Chris Christie. Probably Marco Rubio. But I do think that if you study Mitt Romney's personality and his gut, I think he's probably just as likely to go with a very boring pick, like Bob McDonnell, the governor of Virginia, Rob Portman, a senator from Ohio, these sort of milquetoast, moderate, average Republicans. I think that's what Romney's very comfortable with. And they would be safe choices. They're not going to embarrass him. They're going to be, you know, the media is going to praise it as a smart governing choice. But I think it's a way that he can be very smart and be very safe and still lose in a very safe manner.
Right.
I'd like to see him pick someone like Marco Rubio.
Sarah Palin was on Fox this week, and she was calling for Alan West. Any thoughts there?
I don't see that happening. Interestingly, I will say this. I mean, first of all, Alan West is a newly elected member of the House of Representatives.
Right.
He's only been in Congress for less than 2 years, I believe.
Right.
He certainly has military experience, and he's well-regarded. Look at the guy's record, though. He's really not all that conservative, interestingly. I'm not saying that to disqualify her, but I would say that because he's kind of brash, he tends to be – there's a perception that he's Mr. Conservative. Actually, he's not all that conservative, which is quite funny.
Interesting.
There were two African-American Republicans elected in 2010 to the House of Representatives. Tim Scott from South Carolina is actually, I would argue, more conservative.
All right. We're coming up on a break here. Our guest today is Matt Lewis, senior contributor from the Daily Caller. If folks want to find out more about you, subscribe to your iTunes podcast. How do they do that?
Well, the best thing is to go to the Daily Caller. They pay me, so go to dailycaller.com and just click on my little blog, Matt Lewis and the News.
All right, thedailycaller.com. We'll put a link up on our website. Matt, thanks so much for being with us today. You've been a great guest.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're coming up on a